the Stoughton years. For now shalt thou go forth out of the city, and thou shalt dwell in the field. Micah. Mrs. Glover had met the Wentworth family shortly after moving to the Crafts home in East Stoughton. The younger daughter, Lucy, wrote, quote, "When Hiram Crafts brought her to our fireside, we just felt as if an angel had come into our home." End quote. When she returned to Lynn, they had invited her to come to live with them. But it was in September of 1868 before she accepted the invitation. Mrs. Glover had many friends and acquaintances in Lynn, and spent part of 1868 there, probably both before and after moving to Stoughton. During one of these visits, an escaped lunatic burst into the house where she was staying, badly frightening the woman of the house and her daughter. When Mrs. Glover responded to the woman's call, the man raised a chair to strike her, but she faced him fearlessly and compassionately. She spoke to him, and he dropped the chair, pointing upward as he approached, saying, "Are you from there?" He fell on his knees at her feet, sobbing with his head in his hands. When he looked up, he said, "That terrible weight has gone off the top of my head." And he departed in his right mind. 16 years later, in 1884, Mrs. Eddy was living on Columbus Avenue in Boston when this same man called on her. He had returned to the asylum, had been discharged as cured, and gone to live in the West. His healing had been instantaneous and permanent. He had married and had children, and now he had traced his healing to Mrs. Eddy and her science, and had come to express his gratitude. Another of Mrs. Glover's early healings in Lynn was that of Mrs. Abigail Winslow. She had paid her dear friends a brief visit, perhaps before deciding to move to Stoughton, and wrote of this visit. "When I went there, Mrs. Winslow was very lame and sick, had not walked upstairs naturally for years, and given up trying to go out at all. I stopped 2 days, and when I came away, she walked to the depot with me, almost a mile. They were one and all urgent for me to stay, but I am not of their opinion. I don't want society." Mrs. Glover had instead chosen the humble home of Sally and Allison Wentworth. Supporting a large family on a very small farm had not been easy for the Wentworths, and Mr. Wentworth's ill health had made it even more difficult, for he was unable to work. Their income had been supplemented by his wife, who had become a rubbing doctor, devoting much of her time to caring for the sick. Husband and wife were both deeply grateful to Mrs. Glover for Mr. Wentworth's healing. Several years later, he wrote of it as follows: "I cheerfully give my testimony to the wonderful efficacy of the science Mrs. Glover teaches in its application to my case. I was the melancholy victim of sciatica in the hip for many long years. At times, I could neither lie, sit, nor stand without great suffering. When I first saw Mrs. Glover, she told me she could cure me. But I must say it seemed impossible after suffering so long and trying so many things that I could be healed without medicine or application of any sort. Yet such was the case, I improved until my hip disease left me, and I am completely rid of it. Allenson C. Wentworth, Stoughton, Massachusetts, 1873. I was also cured of an inveterate habit of smoking and chewing tobacco. A. C. Wentworth. Mr. Wentworth was an opinionated Bible scholar who loved Mrs. Glover's explanations. Mrs. Wentworth was eager to learn her method of healing in order to improve her own work. 19-year-old Celia leaned on Mrs. Glover because of delicate health. 17-year-old Charles and his friends sought Mrs. Glover's company for companionship. And the youngest Wentworth, 13-year-old Lucy, idolized Mrs. Glover. She told Sybil Wilbur, "I loved her because she made me love her. She was beautiful and had a good influence over me. I used to be with her every minute that she was not writing or otherwise engaged, and I was very jealous of her book. We talked and read together and took long walks in the country. I idolized her and really suffered when she locked her door to work and would not let me come to her. After she had worked for hours, she always relaxed and threw off her seriousness. Then she would admit us, my brother Charles and me, and sometimes a school friend of Charles. The boys would romp in her room, sometimes rather boisterously, but she never seemed to mind it. Our times alone were quieter. When she finally left our house, it seemed to me my heart would break. She made a great deal of me, yet her influence over me was always for good. We read good books and talked of spiritual things. She loved nature. She was cultivated and well-bred. Her manners seemed to me so beautiful that I imitated her in everything. I never missed anyone as I missed her." Mrs. Glover subscribed to 2 magazines, particularly for Charles's benefit, and she bought a backgammon board and taught them to play. But in this busy, active household, she had to lock her door to work, which she did regularly, devoting most of her time to her writing. She was instructing Sally Wentworth and often helping her with difficult cases, but she longed for a student that would seek the principle of her teaching. She had also learned that younger people were often more tractable than their elders. As she has so beautifully worded it, quote, "While age is halting between 2 opinions, youth makes rapid and easy strides forward," end quote. The previous March, Sally Wentworth had written her in Amesbury. The newsy letter had included the sentences, "Hiram Crafts and wife made us a call last Sunday. He says he has not given up doctoring." So now the teacher wrote to her first student, asking whether he would be willing to take up the work again. His reply of November 27th read in part, "I should be willing to do all you ask if I was in different circumstances. You know how things stand with me. After all the trouble that we have had, I feel the same interest in the developing of truth and its principles. I know that I am not perfect and am willing to acknowledge that fact. But it would be impossible for me to come over there to help you at present. I should have no peace at home if I did. I have been through one hell and don't want to go through another. Your letter was opened and read before I got it. If you send another, have it delivered to me. As to doctoring again, I do not think now that I shall ever do any more of it. If I was alone, perhaps it would be different. But as it is, I must live out this miserable life in darkness and error. If Hiram Crafts was not willing to take up the work for truth, another young man was. Richard Kennedy, whom she had first met at the Websters in Amesbury, visited her in Stoughton and wrote her frequently. Mary's letters to him for the next year or more, which he never shared with anyone, amounted to a mail-order course of instruction. But her main work during all the long months in Stoughton was her writing. In her teaching, she allowed both Sally Wentworth and Richard Kennedy to rub the head as Quimby had done. She also allowed Mrs. Wentworth to copy the 15 questions she had put to Dr. Quimby several years earlier. But these questions and answers were becoming increasingly inadequate. So she wrote a preface to give them a more spiritual meaning. Mary had endowed Dr. Quimby with her own ideal, and then made him think it was his own. But she herself did not yet see this clearly. She did, however, find it necessary to formulate her own questions and answers in teaching her students. And the 35 questions and answers in moral science given by Mrs. Glover and preserved by Sally Wentworth are very different from the Quimby paper. The earliest version in Mrs. Wentworth's handwriting is entitled, quote, Rudiments, The Science of Man, by Mary M. Glover, for the learners, end quote. One day, William Scott came hurriedly to the Wentworth house and implored Mrs. Glover to come quickly. His father, John Scott, was in critical condition. After several remedies had failed, they had sent for Mrs. Wentworth. When Sally Wentworth had arrived, she was so alarmed by his condition that she said she dared not take the case and urged William to go for Mrs. Glover. Mary came immediately and found Mr. Scott vomiting, rolling on the floor, cursing violently, and at times shrieking in agony. Two medical doctors had just left his room, saying there was no hope. Mrs. Glover told him she could heal him if he would cease and be calm. He did as requested. In less than an hour, the pain was entirely gone. The vomiting had ceased, and the bowels, which had not moved in 2 weeks, acted normally. By the time Mrs. Glover left, he said he felt perfectly well, and he was at work the next day. But Mr. Scott's real healing was of his character. A few days later, his wife told Mrs. Glover that he had never caressed his children, as other fathers did, but on the night of his recovery, he had taken them in his arms and told them he loved them. With tears streaming down his cheeks, he told his wife he was going to be a better man. The grateful wife said, "Oh, how I thank you for restoring my husband to health. But more than all, I am grateful for what you have done for him, morally and spiritually." Mrs. Glover's work was never like that of her students. In 1909, after reading of a student's experiences in healing, she said, "No such experiences ever come to me. I reach the results without intermediate steps. If anyone was said to be ill in the next room, I wouldn't have to treat. I would just know the truth about them, and they would seem to be no more sick or dead than you are. I cannot tell you how I do it, but I have none of the experiences recorded by others, though I enjoy reading them. By June of 1869, Mary had completed the volume she was working on. She wrote to a friend in Rumney, "I have just sent a work to the press for publication entitled Science of Soul. I mean, you shall read it sometime. I have written this and notes on the entire book of Genesis within the last year, and this, besides laboring for clothes and other expenses with teaching, I am worn almost out, have lost my love of life completely, and want to go where the weary have a rest, and the heavy laden lay down their burdens." The petty annoyances of personal life harassed the revelator to this age, and poverty plagued her every footstep. But the rewards of spiritual discovery were a recompense. She could look back and say, quote, "The search was sweet, calm, and buoyant with hope, not selfish nor depressing," end quote. She wrote to Sarah Bagley a few days later with a more triumphant note. "My volume is finished, Sarah, and ready for the press and the outcry that will follow it. First the ridicule, then the argument, and lastly the adoption by the public. But it may be long ere the public get it. I only wish I were able to launch into the fullness of Christ, embrace the whole world in my love." Historians seem to know nothing about this volume, Science of Soul, but it is certain that it was not published. Mrs. Glover paid Lucy Wentworth's cousin, Kate Porter, $7 to copy it for her, but copying was all she did for Mrs. Glover. Behind her back, she ridiculed and mocked her. And she was not alone in this. She was joined in her mockery by the oldest Wentworth son, Horace, who was married and lived nearby. Though their unkind remarks were not made to Mrs. Glover nor in her presence, she was not deceived. Her teachings were being derided and resisted, while the healings she performed in East Doubton, Amesbury, and Lynn were as miraculous as those by the Sea of Galilee and the hills of Judea. She was truly seeking and finding, as she recorded in her beautiful poem, Christ and Christmas. What the beloved knew and taught, science repeats, through understanding dearly sought, with fierce heartbeats. During these early years of Mrs. Glover's work, she healed all manner of sickness and disease, most of the cases at death's door and considered hopeless. If all these healings were written down, they would fill many books, for the streets of Lynn resounded with her cures. She told of one such case in these early days of her poverty. "I was walking along the street in Lynn. I walked because I hadn't a cent to ride. And I saw this cripple with one knee drawn up to his chin resting on his knee. The other limb was drawn the other way up his back. I came up to him and read on a piece of paper pinned on his shoulder, 'Help this poor cripple.' I had no money to give him, so I whispered in his ear, 'God loves you.' And he got up perfectly straight and well. He ran into the house of Mrs. Lucy Allen, who saw the healing from her window and asked, 'Who is that woman?' pointing to Mrs. Glover. Mrs. Allen replied, It is Mrs. Glover. No, it isn't. It's an angel, he said. Then he told what had been done for him. When Mrs. Glover was called to a case, her ability to perceive mortal thought revealed the cause of the sickness immediately, and her spiritually uplifted thought usually healed it just as immediately in one treatment, never more than three. She was never wrong, and she never failed. But she did have one experience which looked like failure temporarily, but which was really a beautiful incident for her own enlightenment and progress, and for ours. She told this experience to the last class she taught in November 1898, and there was not a dry eye when she finished. In her early experience when she healed the sick, the most desperate cases, before getting to them, none would acknowledge that she did it. She was troubled at this, for she feared God would not get the glory, and Christian Science be slow in becoming established. One day, she was sent for to go to a dying man, and before starting to his house, she knelt by her bed and asked God that the patient might not be healed till she got there, so that God's power be acknowledged and Him glorified. She said, "When I got there, I couldn't do a thing. I went home and put my face upon the carpet, and there I stayed until I found Jacob's ladder from the bottom to the top. Then I saw that God in His own time and way would take unto Himself the glory, and it was not for me to say." The case was healed, and the man recovered. She also asked this last class how they would heal instantaneously. After all had answered, she said, quote, "Now let me tell you how I'd heal instantaneously. It is not so much to realize the presence of love, but love. Love enough, and you'll raise the dead. I've done it." End quote. While Mrs. Glover was healing the most desperate cases, till the streets of Lynn rang with her works, and the folks of Amesbury expected her to walk on the water, she was faced with the problem that Henry David Thoreau had voiced a few years earlier, i.e., quote, "Can a man feed and clothe himself gloriously who keeps only the truth steadily before him? Who calls in no evil to his aid?" End quote. On July 1, 1893, Mrs. Eddy said to her artist at the easel, "Oh, Mr. Gilman, I sometimes used to wonder, why does not God provide for my needs? I, who was raising the incurably sick, to medical sense, to health and strength, so speedily as to cause amazement, even from death's door, and in the families of the wealthy, while I was often hungry for the want of simple things that I craved, ordinarily considered necessities of life, because I lacked the material means for obtaining them. But God, in His graciousness, was testing me. That was all. You see, at that time, I thought it would be wrong to take anything for doing such Christly work. I thought it was a gift from God to be able to heal as Christ healed, and that I ought not to take money for it. I worked and healed 4 years in this way, without money and without price. And then, God having tested me, He showed me a better way. This better way, shown by God to the woman of the Apocalypse, has cast down the power of Babylon, that great city, so that there is much weeping and wailing in the world, but rejoicing among the saints. Every student of Christian Science, after he has demonstrated health, is faced with the problem of supply, and this is a greater problem for the worldly wealthy than for those who suffer lack. Quote, "Because thou sayest, I am rich, and have need of nothing, and knowest not that thou art wretched and miserable, and poor and blind and naked." End quote. If thou wouldst be rich, learn and follow the better way that the woman has set forth, for through her teachings and example, we find the gold tried in the fire. The Partnership. While Horace Wentworth was ridiculing and scoffing in East Stoughton, young Richard Kennedy was applying himself assiduously in Amesbury. His eagerness was a joy to the teacher, and she poured out to him freely all that she was teaching to Sally Wentworth, and perhaps more, for he was an apt pupil with an exceptionally keen intellect. Though she had formulated much more for her second and third students than she had for Hiram Crafts in his brief experience with her, she was nonetheless feeling her way as she went along. She wrote, "In the beginning, to know how the students could mentally practice on the sick puzzled me. I had not by any material means or method demonstrated on the sick the power of divine science, and did not believe that my students at the start could reach my purely mental attitude of healing. I thought they must approach it from their standpoints and gain the results of truth on themselves before they could practice through prayer and heal the sick." Still believing that Quimby's healing was somewhat akin to hers, she included his material method of rubbing the patient's head as an intermediate step for her students, instructing them in application. "First, to leave your own belief or body, then you will be in principle, and there be able to speak to another in this principle, in which immortality controls the body. If this wisdom be not yet fully attained, the next method is by rubbing the head, while at the same time take yourself utterly away from all thought of his complaints or their locality in matter." Mary had very severe experiences ahead before learning that any physical contact is an avenue for mesmerism. But that lesson lay in the future. The present lesson was a proper and adequate sense of supply, or how to feed and clothe oneself gloriously without forsaking truth. Experience had taught her that even the barest necessities were unobtainable without money. The attitude of society toward money was that it was worldly and had no place in Christ's church, often considering that all lucre was filthy lucre. Mrs. Glover was learning, as she later wrote in the Scientific Statement of Being, that, quote, "all is infinite mind and its infinite manifestation," end quote. Then every so-called worldly or filthy thing must be redeemed, not denied. In time, she gave her followers this beautiful spiritual definition of money, the coin of Christian Science: gold, the silent thoughts of truth and love, which heal the sick. Silver, the spoken word of truth and love, which casts out evil and heals the sick. Currency, the written word of truth and love, published and distributed throughout the world, healing sickness and sin. But this currency must be backed up by a gold reserve in human character. In 1870, Mrs. Glover had to make practical application of what God had been revealing to her about substance and supply. God was teaching her what he had spoken to Isaiah centuries earlier. Quote, "Thus saith the Lord thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, I am the Lord thy God, which teacheth thee to profit, which leadeth thee by the way that thou shouldst go." End quote. Mary had had an agreement with Hiram Crafts for a small percentage on his practice, but she had realized nothing from this agreement. She had a similar agreement with Sally Wentworth, and by early 1870, Mrs. Wentworth was earning $50 a week from her practice. But once again, Mary was not paid. She wrote in retrospect, "I taught Mrs. Wentworth Christian Science more from sympathy than for money. For she had told me that owing to her husband's long illness and inability to work, they were poor. My terms for tuition were a small percentage on her practice, but I made no demands for this and took no legal action to obtain it." The time had come when Mary was called upon to make God's business more businesslike. On the 20th of February, she entered into an agreement with Richard Kennedy in writing. The young man had been studying Mrs. Glover's science for 2 years, and he was eager to enter the full-time practice of mental healing. He was also eager to sign his name to the statement, quote, "In consideration of 2 years' instruction in healing the sick, I hereby agree to pay Mary M. B. Glover $1,000 in quarterly installments of $50, commencing from this date," end quote. He valued his instruction very highly, and Mrs. Glover had great hope for his future. The time had also arrived for Mary to move on from East Stoughton. Her hometown of Sandmorton Bridge had been renamed Tilton the previous year in honor of its first family and their industry. But Sandmorton Bridge, or Tilton, was no longer Mary's home. Over the past several years, Lynn had become home to her, and now she thought of returning there. But that was a little farther in the future. The present was calling her back to Amesbury. Sarah Bagley was very desirous of instruction by Mrs. Glover in healing the sick. Mary had suggested that Dickie instruct her while she had been instructing him, but either he had not tried or he was unsuccessful. So Mrs. Glover made arrangements toward the end of February to return to Amesbury. After she had bidden all the family a fond farewell, Mr. Wentworth took her to the depot and thanked her cordially for what she had done for him and his family. Her goodbye to Lucy had been particularly touching, and with great affection. She had held her in her arms and looked long into her eyes. Then she said sadly, "You too will turn against me some day, Lucy." Her words were as prophetic as Jesus's when he said to Peter, "Before the cock crow, thou shalt deny me thrice." After arriving in Amesbury, the next 6 weeks were spent in teaching Sarah Bagley and Richard Kennedy. At the end of that time, on the 23rd of April, Miss Bagley signed an agreement to pay Mrs. Glover 25% of all the money she earned by healing in return for the instruction. And that instruction enabled her to make a very comfortable living for the rest of her life. Mrs. Glover later reduced the percentage to 10, and then even lower. But when Mrs. Glover had to renounce her teaching of physical manipulation as a method and forbid its further use by her students, Miss Bagley was not able to follow the teacher's instruction. In 1876, their contract was canceled by mutual agreement, and Sarah was left behind with the cast-off beliefs that the discoverer was forced to discard. She never renounced her teacher, and over the next 20 years, purchased numerous copies of Science and Health for her friends and patients. When she took a copy to John Greenleaf Whittier, he examined it slowly and carefully, and then said to Sarah, quote, "Well, you will never be able to understand 1/10 part of it during your lifetime," end quote. During the weeks in Amesbury, Mrs. Glover and Richard Kennedy had been making plans for the future. The previous September, he had written her, quote, "In my future experience with the world, Mary, I do not expect to obtain applause and popularity." This could not be, for truth will have its opposite, and in this will be contention and strife, end quote. For one so young, Richard was surprisingly dedicated to the work at hand, that of establishing the scientific mental healing of moral science, and he also had the buoyancy and enthusiasm of youth. What a joy and a help to the teacher! Mary had written Sarah Bagley from Stoughton after receiving a particularly appreciative letter from Richard. Quote, "Was there ever a more glorious nature, a more noble soul than Richard Kennedy possesses?" End quote. Once again, she was endowing another with her own qualities and ideals. But for the time, being this endowment was lifting the young man to new heights. In the spring, Mary made plans to return to Lynn, where she was well known, and to bring her young student with her to demonstrate her teaching. Their agreement was that she would supervise his practice and teach her method of healing to others. They drew up a legal partnership agreement regarding the healing practice. But this partnership did not include Mary's teaching and writing. That was solely between Mary and God. In May, Mary and the fledgling doctor left Amesbury. In Lynn, they stayed temporarily with her friends, Mr. and Mrs. Oliver, until they should find suitable quarters. This was accomplished quickly, and by June, they were located at No. 2 Shepherd Street, occupying the second floor of a large house opposite Lynn Common, on the corner of South Common and Shepherd Streets. The success of this venture was almost immediate. Mary wrote Sarah Bagley on the 15th of July, "I have all calling on me for instruction. Richard is literally overrun with patients. We enjoy our moments of leisure more than can be named." On the evening of the 4th, Our rooms were filled with company to hear the concert given on the common by the brass band. At this time, Mrs. Glover's business cards read simply, Mrs. Mary M. Glover, teacher of moral science. And the first business she attended to was rewriting the questions and answers she had developed for her pupils into textbook form. This was copyrighted in 1870 as, quote, The Science of Man, by which the sick are healed, or Questions and Answers in Moral Science, end quote. Here again, God's business was being run in a business-like way, for her class book was protected by copyright, even though it was not printed at this time. The first section of this class book was handed to each pupil in manuscript form at the beginning of class. This manuscript consisted of 25 questions and answers, which are very similar to the 24 questions in recapitulation in the latest edition of Science and Health, although the terminology is sometimes different and often broadening and helpful. For example, seventh question, what is matter? Answer, matter held as shadow is the idea of God, but matter held as substance is a belief and error. 13th question, what is sense? Answer, it belongs to the soul and not to the body, and this sense gives the idea of truth and never errs. There were yet two remnants of Quimbyism not yet eradicated from Mrs. Glover's thought. One was the belief that the healer takes on the ills of his patients. This did not seem to affect young Dr. Kennedy, whose office was filled with sick and suffering individuals. But the spiritually sensitive teacher and director of his work, who was responsible for all the healing, was affected. She wrote to her friend in Swampscott, Mrs. Mary Ellis, on the 23rd of July. Never did the life that seems appear so small to me as this year, and never the life that is so vast, so glorious. My own health is greatly affected by the many sick ones that surround me, but if I can aid them out of the dark places my feet have trod, I am happier even though I suffer physically. By mid-July, Richard was overrun with patients, and by mid-August, Mrs. Glover was preparing to teach her first class. She placed the following advertisement in the Lynn Semi-Weekly Reporter on August 13th. Mrs. Glover, the well-known scientist, will receive applications for 1 week from ladies and gentlemen who wish to learn how to heal the sick without medicine and with a success unequaled by any known method of the present day at Dr. Kennedy's office, number 71, South Common Street, Lynn, Massachusetts. Mrs. Glover required each student to sign a contract before entering the class. The first two students to enroll by signing such an agreement on the 15th of August were George H. Tuttle and Charles S. Stanley, the brother and husband of a woman who had had treatment from Dr. Kennedy and been healed of tuberculosis in an advanced stage. Daniel and Addie Spofford signed a contract 2 days later on the 17th of August. However, only Mrs. Spofford attended class in 1870. Mrs. Glover's original agreement for class instruction was as follows. We, the undersigned, do hereby agree, in consideration of instruction and manuscripts received from Mrs. Mary Baker Glover, to pay annually on the income that we receive from practicing or teaching the science. We also agree to pay her $1,000 in case we do not practice or teach the above-mentioned science that she has taught us. G. H. Tuttle, Charles S. Stanley. These two young men were far from exemplary students, but they do depict the problems the teacher encountered. George Tuttle was a young seaman, just returned from Calcutta, who joined the class because his sister wanted him to, with little, if any, thought about the subject matter. When, after a few lessons, he cured a girl of dropsy, he was so alarmed that he dropped the study completely. Stanley, on the other hand, was an argumentative, dogmatic Baptist, determined to disrupt every lesson with constant disagreement. Mrs. Glover had to dismiss him before the 3-week course ended. Neither young man had paid his tuition in full, but Stanley set himself up as a doctor and practiced mental healing for several years. Jesus taught his message to the simple fishermen, and Mrs. Glover taught hers to the shoe workers from the factories and shops of Lynn. Early in the fall, Mr. and Mrs. Spofford called upon Samuel Putnam Bancroft, who was foreman in the shoe factory of Bancroft and Purington, where Daniel Spofford was employed. Mrs. Spofford had been treated by Dr. Kennedy and been greatly benefited. She was entering the fall class of the wonderful woman who taught Dr. Kennedy, and the Spoffords were eager for Mr. Bancroft to do the same. After an interview with Mrs. Glover, Samuel Bancroft enrolled in the class, as did a number of others. The contract had been eliminated, and the tuition changed. Mrs. Eddy later wrote, "I could think of no financial equivalent for an impartation of a knowledge of that divine power which heals. But I was led to name $300 as the price for each pupil in one course of lessons, a startling sum for tuition lasting barely 3 weeks. This amount greatly troubled me. I shrank from asking it, but was finally led by a strange providence to accept this fee." This amount continued to be her tuition charge throughout the 19 years of her class teaching. However, she had a great many charity scholars, as many as 17 in one class. In this November 1870 class, Mrs. Miranda Rice was admitted free because she could not obtain the money from her well-to-do husband. But her sister, Miss Dorcas Rawson, who was a shoe worker, paid the full amount. George Allen paid in full. 17-year-old George Berry paid only one half, but was receipted in full. Samuel Bancroft has left an interesting description of this early class. The class meetings were held at Mrs. Glover's house on the corner of South Common and Shepherd Streets, and the course consisted of 12 lessons. Before studying, we were treated by Dr. Kennedy in order to render us receptive and to acquaint us with the physical methods used, after which Mrs. Glover was to teach us the spiritual methods. Dr. Kennedy's treatment consisted of a manipulation of the head and solar plexus. The theory, as we understood it, was that these were considered the most sensitive portions of the body. Mrs. Glover taught us, however, that there was no sensation in matter. To some of us, this seemed a paradox. After being treated by Dr. Kennedy, pupils were given a manuscript of questions and answers, a portion of which we were required to study, and as far as possible, to memorize each day. We were also given private instruction between lessons, when such seemed needed. Mrs. Glover was a faithful teacher, and even gave her pupils a treatment, if requested. This did not consist of manipulation, however, but of silent or audible argument. While the course of instruction consisted of 12 lessons, we were never really graduated. Every meeting with her was a lesson, every letter received from her. This continued for years. I have never known of any of her loyal students to complain of not receiving full value for money paid, or asking to have it refunded. For my own part, I will say that from my limited practice in healing, I received many times the amount I paid her, besides enjoying over 50 years of almost perfect health. At the end of the class, the students were given another manuscript entitled, quote, "The Soul's Inquiries of Man," end quote, which is the second part of The Science of Man, an essay of instructions for advancement in moral science. Bancroft, the shoe manufacturer, voiced the general public opinion when he learned that his nephew had studied with Mrs. Glover. Quote, "My boy, you will be ruined for life. It is the work of the devil," end quote. But the students were inspired and exalted by their instruction and quite dedicated to future work. The Spoffords moved immediately to the South, where Mrs. Spofford began to practice metaphysical healing. Samuel Bancroft suggested that the class meet for discussions, and the home of Susan and Clark Oliver became their meeting place, as indicated in this letter. Lynn, December 4th. Mr. Bancroft, "Dear Sir, I was sorry you did not get my word sent you to meet with the class Saturday Eve at Mr. Oliver's. You first proposed it, and I acted upon your suggestion, naming it to Mr. O. He was delighted and said, quote, 'Have them meet here,' end quote. And accordingly they did. Mr. Allen went to your place of business the day before to inform you, but found you not. The class meets every Saturday Eve at 7 o'clock at Mr. O's. I have a little Bible that I purchased for you about a week since, and will be happy to send it to you by Dr. Kennedy at your next meeting at Mr. Oliver's. Very truly, M.M.B. Glover. P.S. You see, I do not forget you, and you must not forget yourself." Mrs. Glover enjoyed a visit from her nephew George Baker in December 1870. He had just graduated from the New Hampshire Conference Seminary. During his visit, his aunt wrote in his autograph album, "If an avalanche roll from its alp, ye tremble at the will of Providence. Is not that will concerned when the sere leaves fall from the poplar? A thing is great or little only to a mortal's thinking. Early in the new year, Mrs. Glover received a letter from a very promising young man, 25-year-old Wallace W. Wright, a bank accountant and son of a Universalist minister, was considering entering her next class and asked her to respond to the 9 questions he included in his letter. His 6th question and Mrs. Glover's answer are of special import because it is the last time she was to relate her discovery to Quimby's theory. Question 6. Has this theory ever been advertised or practiced before you introduced it, or by any other individual? Answer. Never advertised and practiced, only by one individual who healed me, Dr. Quimby of Portland, Maine, an old gentleman who had made it a research for 25 years, starting from the standpoint of magnetism, thence going forward and leaving that behind. I discovered the art in a moment's time, and he acknowledged it to me. He died shortly after, and since then, 8 years, I have been founding and demonstrating the science. Mary knew that Dr. Quimby started from the standpoint of magnetism. But alas, she knew too little about animal magnetism and had yet to learn that that had been the basis of his entire practice. Quimby did not understand the basis of his own practice, and because of his benevolent nature, neither he nor his one ardent disciple had any comprehension of its potential use for evil instead of good. But experience would soon teach her this difficult lesson. In the meanwhile, Mr. Wright enrolled in her next class, which convened in April and proved to be a student of considerable talent. At the close of the course, he said that the last lesson alone was worth the entire tuition. He went to Knoxville, Tennessee, to assist Mrs. Spofford, who was doing very well in that city. Shortly afterward, Richard Kennedy asked Mrs. Glover whether she had heard the reports of Wallace Wright's success in the South. When she said that she had, and that she had expected it from him, the color came to Richard's face, and a momentary look of indescribable envy. He made a derogatory remark about Wright, ending with, quote, "I hope he will do well, but I am afraid you will be sorry you ever took Wright for a student of metaphysics," end quote. But because Richard was affable and Irish, youthful and buoyant, Mrs. Glover disregarded the incident and his words as merely a passing remark. She did not see the wanton petulance he was beginning to cherish in thought, for he intentionally cloaked it with an air of innocence. It would be another year before their partnership would be legally terminated. But the dissolution had begun in Kennedy's thought.